Hi, I'm Anne DeLisi. Welcome to episode 20 of Essential Conversations. In December of 2015, Frank Sinatra would have turned 100 years old. To honor him, there were music celebrations, exhibits, and HBO's documentary about his life, All or Nothing at All. At that same time, his daughter, Tina Sinatra, was doing interviews in which she talked about her iconic father, their family, and his music.
And hi, Detroit.
Hi. It is so great to talk to you. What a pleasure. What an absolute pleasure. Thank you for making the time, and thank you for being on an ISDN. I think your father would have appreciated it.
I am in the Capitol Tower.
How great is that? I have consumed more Frank Sinatra information than I think humanly possible in the last 24 hours, and it has been quite a journey.
Oh, my.
It's been quite a journey.
But you listen to his music?
Of course I do. I think The Best Is Yet to Come is one of the best songs ever recorded with him and the Count Basie Orchestra.
Yeah,
just incredible. Just incredible. So given that your father would have turned 100 years old today, one of the things that struck me when I was reading about him and doing my research was I want to go back before your father entered the world and talk about his mother, your grandmother, Dolly Sinatra. Mm-hmm. I think a movie could be made about her and would be as fascinating as any movie about him.
She was a force to be reckoned with. And given that, little Frankie would be her only child, she was pretty guarded of him and could be tough on him for little things like getting a suit dirty and mm-hmm. stuff. You know, like that. But she had a terrible delivery. He was born dead. Forceps had torn his left ear off, and he was bleeding to death. And he was blue and not making any sounds. And they set him aside, trying to figure out what to do. But in those days, it was a, midwife birth. Mm-hmm. And Dad's grandmother, Rose, grabbed him up and put him under running cold water in December, cold water flat, by the way, so that's all they had. And he let out a shry, and they got a doctor in time to reattach the ear, and the rest is history. But Grandma Dolly always said she knew at that time when he let out that scream that he was going to be a singer.
Started then. I mean, that's an incredible entry into the world. That's an unbelievable way to start your life. And then he went on to have an unbelievable life.
He was driven from that moment. He was born to do exactly what he did. It was a God-given gift anyway. I mean, he could be nothing but a singer.
What has been, in your experience, the most misreported piece of information about your father that you just say, they got it wrong again?
Well, I read a couple of weeks ago that he was a drug lord.
What?
He was friends with Pablo Escobar. Yeah, that's who it was. And his son, Escobar's son, has written a book claiming that Dad was into cocaine and was a major carrier, like a courier of it, because he was a courier, by the way, for the CIA at times. Anyone with notoriety that people wouldn't screw around with that had private planes, took people and documents surreptitiously. Mm-hmm. But this now is this new one. This is interesting. So I kind of liked it in a way. But the most, it was so stupid. It was funny. I'd say I don't like a lot of the overplay of his links to the mafia. Mm-hmm. People have to understand Dad was born into a neighborhood where they too were born. And they all grew up at the same time. He knew them as children. Mm-hmm. They would then become, remain lifelong friends, the ones he knew from childhood that lived, mm-hmm. that weren't, blown out. He wasn't buds to any deep extreme, but it's an Italian. There's a loyalty that runs deep in Italian male mentality, and he could know it might not be right to help somebody who walked the other side of the law, but he wouldn't not help them. And when he was hungry and couldn't feed his children, the home. that he had left, you know, when I was just a baby. And he wasn't hireable in the big clubs across the country. The guys he knew as a youth owned them, their own clubs. And they put him to work, the 500 Club in Atlantic City, to name one. I think he got to Vegas earlier than not because of the his friendships or his acquaintances. Most of them were that. In Las Vegas, Nevada. So I think he helped build. I was just there last week for 4 days, and all the journalists were saying, it seems like your father helped build the city. And I said, I can't imagine any other way of putting it. But I don't like the, you know, Freedom of Information Act gave us access to all files and things. There was never anything that linked Dad in a criminal way. He wasn't that kind of human being anyway. But he wouldn't squeal on his friends, you know, as he used to put it. And he didn't like bullies. And he was loyal, as loyal as anyone could ever be. And when he was many suggested he would walk away from people easily and never look back. I remember reading that a million times in my life. Well, if that person he walked away from was disloyal, this is that Italian thing again. That's how those guys handle it. I'm out of the mob now. I'm just saying, Dad was a typical Italian male who made good for himself. You know.
I'm talking with Tina Sinatra here on 101.9 WDET. You're listening to Essential Music. Was he a perfectionist?
Yes. He was also very neat and tidy, which I love. I got that
he always
him.
Looked great. I mean, every photo you see of him, he dressed impeccably.
He was a style setter. Everything he did was impeccable, to tell you the truth. Even when he was sloppy, he was not wrinkled. I never saw him wrinkle. I figured out how he'd get off a plane and not have a crease, and that's because he'd walk his way to where he was going. And he just eventually it was suitable to get a private plane because he could relax. If you relaxed on a public plane with him, he'd get mobbed, you know. He'd always have his guard up. He was methodical.
Well, when I was reading about him being in the studio, and your father was, he didn't know how to read music, but it certainly didn't get in his way. And it impressed people around him at how incredibly musical he was, how he could hear things and how he could interpret things, and that he was a conductor in his own right. Were you ever in any of the sessions when you were a kid watching him with an orchestra performing and leading? Do you remember, if you were in there, do you remember?
When he was conducting?
Conducting or recording, singing.
Yes, I have memories of him recording. One or two in this Capitol Tower. It's a wonderful, nostalgic place, this great tower. I remember more of the Reprise era because I was older. Yeah, and, you know, he was at home in a recording studio, and, you know, he had a full orchestra around him, and he was off to a side with maybe a baffle of glass that he could still see everything and they could see him. And he'd sing live. No tricks, you know, no. At the time, it was started out at Capitol on single track, went to three track, and then eventually 12, and they kept getting more and more sophisticated. But he always recorded live in the room with the orchestra. He didn't like to be isolated in a booth or separated at all.
Let's talk about the song My Way. I've read a couple of places that he did not like that song, and it is a signature song for him, as are many others. How did he feel about that song?
He didn't dislike the song. My Way became like an anthem. I think that might be his term. I've heard it somewhere. I think that, you know, he began loving it and singing it. It was new and it was working, God knows. It was a huge hit for him. But, you know, that becomes something the audience expects. So no matter where he performed, it was always going to be an encore song. And that went on for, I don't know, probably nearly 15, 18 years. And I think, you know, artists get tired of the same songs. But he didn't hate it.
Were there any songs or a song in particular that he absolutely loved to sing over and over? You know, you hear certain artists say that they can sing one particular song over and over and it never gets old for them. Was there a song like that for him?
Well, he had staple titles almost in every show. He'd pick his, select his songs for the night in the afternoon, and he'd change up some more often than others. I don't think I ever watched him perform where he didn't sing "I've Got You Under My Skin" and "A World on a String." You know, "You Make Me Feel So Young," and perhaps he did forfeit one or two of those at a time, you know, or from time to time. He wanted to change up in case someone had seen him in New York 3 weeks before he played Chicago, and you know, so he tried to keep it new, but he had to deliver what they wanted to hear at the same time.
We live in a day and age where in the last few years, I guess the last couple decades, where bands or artists will take weeks to make an album. And it sounds like he could do half of an album in a day and sing a number of songs and sing them beautifully, and those would be the final takes for an album.
Because they were live and in the room, and if they weren't good, everybody knew it. He might put it off to a next session, which might not be the next day. It might have been 3 or 4 weeks later. If you look at his discography, you can see the same title song span a year and a half, and see it's never issued, wasn't issued, and eventually it was issued, or not. Those are some of the early things we did when once Dad left us, was look for the songs that had never been issued to date. He'd play with a song sometimes for many, many months.
And then he would finally get the take that he wanted?
Either get it or not get it. But when it came to doing a 12-sides album, or I don't know, 33 and a third, were they 10 titles? I know that he would do an album in no more than three sessions because I've looked at the schedules of them in my, in my, you know, tenure with doing this. He preferred to get the music one album at a time done, and sometimes he would over-record, and some of those songs would find their way into an album two or three later down the line. But Dad had to allocate his time to record, get out of town, go back on the road, and recording dates were vital to him. It was his favorite thing to do, was go in and live record. So he pretty much started and stopped one album, one project at a time.
Coming up next, Tina Sinatra talks about her parents, Frank Sinatra's work as an actor, and the musicians and singers he liked to listen to.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
I'm Ann DeLisi, and here's the conclusion of my conversation with Tina Sinatra.
I want to talk about the relationship between your parents, because as divorced people, it seems to me from reading what I've read that they had such an unusual relationship for being divorced, and that they still had such a connection. And I wanted you to verify that, and if that is the case, what that was like for you to watch as one of their children.
Well, it was. It made it easy. Obviously, they knew that they had to do the best for their children. They never argued in front of any of us. We never heard an unkind word spoken of one of the other by the other. Mom made it very easy for Dad to have access to us. Sometimes he'd come into town for a day and a half, and if he could be with us an hour or two, she would get us primed and ready, you know, clean us up, get us dressed, and either he'd come to us or we'd be off to him. And of course, she always was open to us traveling to where he was once we were old enough to do that, as long as we were accompanied. We made family trips together, all of us, the five of us at times. She knew that if she made any problems, the children would get the short, you know, end of the short straw. Mm-hmm. She wanted to make it natural and friendly and loving, and our door was, our home was his home, and if he wanted to come to see us, he knew he would, that he could. We would move heaven and earth to spend time with him, and Mom was the best at juggling all the schedules with sleepovers and school and, you know, and Dad's busy life. It was a very good decision they made, and it never faltered.
Was he the love of her life?
Oh, yeah. There's no doubt about it.
He would be a hard act to follow, I suppose.
Well, also, you know, my mother was a Catholic at a point in time when marriage was for life. Mm-hmm. And she's recently said to me, I'm the only one who will live to be 100 and the last voice I hear be Dad's. Because she's going to be 99 in March. And she's a strong, she's sore, you know,
right.
Got aches and pains, but sharp as a tack and quite a remarkable woman. She was really the glue, the substance that held us all together. And Dad could not have done what he did if she had not been that, because he wouldn't let his family down and would have taken up too much of his time. He was to control us, you know, if he had to. He was very lucky to have Mom. In ways, he married the right woman.
Right. I'm talking with Tina Sinatra here on 101.9 WDET. You're listening to Essential Music. Tina, can you talk about his relationship with Nelson Riddle, which seems to me to be an incredible partnership and such mutual respect on such a high level, those two?
Yeah, no, it was a fluke. Dad came to Capitol and Nelson was here, and they... I don't remember who exactly suggested that they go into the studio the first time together and cut Dad's first album, but they clicked, I dare say, and the rest is history. He was very soft-spoken, very sweet. I always felt he was kind of a melancholy man. I didn't know him well. My brother did. He had a family, you know. He worked very hard. He recorded and arranged conducted and arranged for far more artists than just Dad. But Capitol was very dependent on him, and he did a great job. I think that the team is what made this Capitol era so important to this day.
One of the things that I read was a quote from Nelson Riddle, who said, because he would arrange these songs, and that your father would, from time to time, say, well, I think it should be this way, a different way. Mm-hmm. And that Nelson Riddle said that your father's decision was always superior to his.
Well, he was, you know, innate in this business, though he had no education. Nelson, of course, had tremendous musical education. But, you know, Dad always worked well collaboratively. He liked to sound off people. He wanted their input. And I've heard many times that Nelson said, yeah, well, you're right again, you know. But that's what made them great, a great team. And Nelson stayed with Dad, you know, as Dad moved into his reprise era. So, and Gordon Jenkins and Billy May and Don Costa and Quincy Jones. I mean, you work with the best, you're going to get the best.
I could talk to you all day, Tina. I know you have other people to talk to. I have just a couple of other questions. Your father was, he set the standard for incredible singing and performing. Who did he like to listen to?
Oh, gosh, Peggy Lee, Rosie Clooney, Ella, mm-hmm. by all means, Ella Fitzgerald, Tony Bennett. He loved Vic Damone. He liked all of the pop artists, I have to say. He loved Bobby Darin when we were moving into the early 60s. I remember he was at one point kind of sad that Bobby had left, you know, the pop era, the pop market, but loved what he continued to do. He always said, if it's arranged well and the lyric is good and I can understand what they're saying, I'm happy. He just got a little discombobulated when it all went sort of to the hard rock of it, but he thought the Beatles were swell. He really admired them as songwriters first, and
he covered them
and as singers. He could hear them and understand them, so that was a plus.
Mm-hmm. One final question, and then I will definitely let you go on. When it came to acting, I'm going to assume that singing was his first love, and then acting was a close second. Did he enjoy that process when he didn't have total control? It seems like in the studio, ultimately, he would have control over what was going on. But then when you get on a movie set, you are one of a huge ensemble and only have so much control. Was that kind of an issue for him?
This is an interesting question, and I know why you're asking it. I think that Dad had less acting training than he had singing training. I think he knew his limitations as an actor, and I think that he was born to act, and I think he was acting before he was hired, because I think that each lyric, the way he would perform it and deliver it, was acting, honest and pure acting, and I think they go hand in hand with him. The process of filmmaking was a slow process, and yes, there were times when you've heard that he would do a take or two and say, look, I'm not doing this again. I think a lot of that had to do with the fact he was afraid he couldn't do it again. Mm-hmm. I mean, some actors could do 40, 50 takes, and some directors insisted. That was not as easy for him in temperament or in trust of his knowledge or in terms of acting skills. He was a natural at everything he did. It's hard to be natural on take 54, mm-hmm. you know? So I think it was double-edged. And I also think that if he respected the director, if he respected the people he was working with, and he normally, naturally, he would or he wouldn't work with them, I mean, he would be more patient. Mm-hmm. Impatience would come when he felt somebody wasn't thinking, you know. And he might have, to open at the Fontainebleau, you know, 4 days later. And this schedule of this particular picture in 61, whatever it was, I'm mm-hmm. making the whole thing up, would screw that up. And Dad didn't live like that. If he made a date, a commitment, then he wanted to meet it. And a lot of times film production gets out of hand. And more so, I think, now than ever. Spencer Tracy always said to him, Frank, learn your lines and hit your mark.
I was reading that for Ocean's 11, that was the first film to feature the Rat Pack, which I also read that Lauren Bacall was the person that gave them that name, so you'll have to verify that.
It was a different pack of people, but she said, you guys look like a pack of rats. But that was years before.
But when Ocean's 11 was being done, did your father, in fact, pay Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr.'s fees at that time? I was reading about that your father, in order to get them into the film and make sure they were in the film, that he actually paid them himself, which I thought
was
interesting.
Know.
So that was interesting.
I wouldn't put it past him.
Yeah, and that he overpaid them, too, according to this. Uh-huh. He not only paid them, but he overpaid them, of course. Tina Sinatra, you are a joy to talk to, and I think your father would absolutely love all of the attention that he's getting on what would have been his 100th birthday. That's all you've heard about. It's like he put out a new album or something these past couple weeks. How wonderful.
Well, you know what? He deserves it. And it's been a joy this year. It's been a journey and a joy. And it gave us a lot to think about this last 17 years. And he always said, I will last if one generation passes me on. And I thought of it last night. He's gone 17 years. That's 3 years short of a new generation, mm-hmm. of a next generation. So he got passed on one more time. And I think that will continue long after we're all gone.
Absolutely. Tina Sinatra, thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The Essential Conversation series is a production of Detroit's public radio station WDET and supported by ELS Studio 3D. If you enjoyed it, I hope you'll listen to other episodes in this series. Production provided by Rowan Nemisto and original music by Brett Lucas. I'm Ann DeLisi. Thanks so much for listening.